When last we met, we finished up the philosophy of John Locke, and I introduced George Berkeley. We're going to continue today with Berkeley, but there was one thing I forgot to do, and that was summarize some of the main ways that Locke influenced the American founding fathers. I mentioned that they had read him, and that's evident, first of all, in the expression, life, liberty, and property. This is what Locke says the state exists to protect. And of course, it's familiar to most of you. Jefferson changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Jefferson thought it was fairly obvious that the goal that everyone sets themselves in life is to be happy. And that may vary from person to person as to what makes them happy, but happiness is something that everybody inevitably and irresistibly is drawn to as the purpose of one of the goals of life. So he starts with that, and that's what the state exists to promote and protect. It's also they also follow a lot in endorsing the contract theory of government. The contract theory is the one that says there are originally solitary individuals, and then individuals band together in order to create a state, mainly, Locke says, to protect their lives, liberty, and property. And the state isn't for everyone. It's for people who will sign on and pay the tax to support it. But it was easy for those early Americans to endorse a contract theory, and that's what they were doing in the colonies. They were meeting, forming a contract. First, it was only that the states had the different colonies had an arrangement, a trade agreement, and so on. And then later on, they wanted complete unity, and they proposed that. They had a Declaration of Independence in which they declared to the world their intentions and their reasons for being a separate and sovereign country. And in other ways, much of what Locke says about the state of nature seems to be assumed in many of the things the Americans wrote about. But no one that I know of or have read actually came right out and said there are solitary individuals to begin with. Or to begin with, there's a group that's self-sufficient and all individuals depend on the group. And that group becomes a state when it is self-sufficient and then begins to make laws and have arrangements for deciding disputes and hearing cases. That's a little beyond. They didn't need all that. All they needed were what they thought were decent reasons for withdrawing themselves from loyalty to the King of England, who was George III at the time. But the idea then of rights, which we saw in Locke, that because there are natural ethical laws that are known to all people, people don't start out as some kind of amoral brutes, as Hobbes would have had it. Instead, they know that it's wrong to murder, wrong to steal, and so on. And so the idea of rights develops because a right is a corresponding factor to a law of that says something's wrong. If it's wrong and immoral and punishable for you to steal my goods or to murder me or both, then I have a right not to be robbed and not to be assaulted and killed. So the notion of rights comes to the fore. What also comes to the fore is the idea that we saw in Locke of the consent of the governed. What makes a government legitimate, what gives the government not only a right but a duty to make laws, is the consent of those who are governed by it. We saw that Locke got that from Luther, but it's an important idea, especially in the American colonies, because they are saying to King George, we withdraw our consent for you to be our king. You're fired. You've acted like a dictator and we're not going to put up with it anymore. And that was the main point of the Declaration of Independence. The consent of the governed is withdrawn. And there are so many ideas that come up in that time period that is patent that they are very influenced by Locke, even if they moderate it in some ways. It's very clear. And then I pointed out that, like Locke, they did not get rid of the hierarchical view of society with the state at the top. That means government. But they had the democratic idea that the individual citizens have a vote, and they get to say who the office holders in the state will be, and they can vote them out of office if they don't like what they're doing. So there's a lot here that's really different. It follows Locke, and when Locke wrote that stuff, there wasn't a government on earth that followed all those rules. The Americans tried to do it and came close to Locke's vision of government and society. But they didn't get rid of the hierarchy. I wish they had. I wish they had thought, well, let's not have a hierarchy at all. Let's go with this old and yet to come, both old and yet to come idea that of sphere sovereignty, as was developed by in the Netherlands in the end of the 19th century. This is a significant influence in the new country and the new world, and it's a tribute to Locke's legacy. So I thought we needed to summarize that stuff before proceeding with Bishop Berkeley. Berkeley was born in Ireland, but he had English parents. That makes him a citizen of England. And he's welcomed in his daily routines and his work by the Irish people, because he defended them many, many times over in essays that he wrote and published against the mistreatment of the Irish by the English. He got an education. He went to school in Dublin, Trinity College, and at an age when, well, an American scholar is just getting ready to write his PhD dissertation, Berkeley published a work called Principles of Human Knowledge. And in this, he contributes to the ongoing debate started by Locke of sticking with empiricism. Experience is going to be the basis of our knowledge of the world around us, accepting that there are principles of logic and math. And what Berkeley sees is what stirs him and moves him and drives him is that a lot of people who are atheists are also materialists. So what he doesn't like here is the materialism that he thinks underlies most atheists' worldviews. And what he wants to do is affirm both science and the existence of God and ethical values. And, of course, free will. Now, how do you manage to bring off keeping science and free will? That's a big thing that confronts him, just as it did Locke, and as it had the other thinkers, the rationalists, before, that we've already covered. And Berkeley's first publication deals with this right off the bat. And he wants to tackle this so that he ends up being able to affirm the existence of God, ethics, and free will, but keep science while denying, are you ready for this? Denying there is anything physical at all. Whoa. That's going pretty far. Nobody so far has said there are no such things as purely physical objects that make up the external world and produce effects on our minds that are sensory copies of them and so on. We've been through that. Descartes affirmed that. Spinoza affirmed that. Leibniz did. Locke did. And Berkeley says, nope. Nope. I can show you why that doesn't work. That's pretty startling. How are you going to get rid of physical objects and still have science? What's science going to be about? So Berkeley sets out to attack the idea that Galileo first put forward, that all things have primary qualities and secondary qualities. And the primary qualities of a thing are that it occupies space, and that it moves in space, and then all the other features that we regard as physical. It has weight, mass, density, solidity, charge, and things like that. And the difference there is the secondary qualities are colors, sounds, tastes, touches. And these exist in minds, and these exist outside minds. Berkeley thinks he can show you that this distinction, as far as I know, the first person to put it forward was Galileo, but it was explicitly endorsed by Locke. This distinction is faulty, and he can show you that it is. That all the things that are called primary qualities in this scheme of things are in fact bundles of secondary qualities. So how's he going to do that? Well, let me read a bit of him to you, because it's always good to hear an author in his own words. Here we go. As several of these characteristics are observed to accompany each other, they come to be marked by one name, and so to be reputed as one thing. That is the primary qualities. Thus, for example, now secondary qualities, certain color, taste, smell, figure, having been observed to go together, are accounted one distinct thing, signified by the same name. For example, an apple. Other collections of these secondary qualities, these ideas, can constitute a stone, a tree, a book, and sensible things. But none of these do we ever find matter. I find it necessary to suppose a material substrate, his opponent says. This is Berkeley in conversation with somebody that's rejecting his view. And the other fellow says, it's necessary to have a material substance without which the qualities cannot be conceived to exist. But Berkeley replies, a material substratum, you call it. Pray, by which of your senses came you to be acquainted with that being? The guy's going to have to say none of the senses, right? The theory is that external things are purely physical. That's the substance. They give rise to sights, tastes, touches, sounds, and smells by causally affecting minds. So Berkeley asks him, by which of the senses do you know there is such a thing as material substance? Well, it's not itself sensible. We don't perceive it. Its modes and qualities only what its effects on us are what we perceive. It seems then you have a relative notion of it, or that you conceive of it not otherwise than by conceiving of the relations to the sensations. And here is something that Berkeley invented. I'll put it down here. Berkeley invented the idea of a notion. He coined the term. It means something that occurs in a mind. That's all it meant. And he wanted it because we're already talking about perceptions and concepts and calling them both ideas. That can be confusing. So he wants another word, a kind of catch-all for anything in the mind. So he's arguing with this fellow and he's saying, be pleased, therefore, to tell me in what this relation consists. This guy says, no, the material isn't an idea. It's not a percept that occurs in our mind. What occurs to us is that it would require some physical substratum in the thing to give rise to the sensory qualities that we perceive. Oh, so Berkeley's already said to him, and by which perception, do you know this, that there's physical things? Do you see them, taste them, hear them, smell them? And the guy says, no, those are the effects of the material on our senses. So, and then the fellow says, no, those are no, those perceptions are not of a material thing. They don't convey to us a thing with only physical properties. Instead, it's the relations between the ideas that it produces in us that gives us the idea of a substratum, of a substance. Well, tell me what that relation is then. Well, haven't I said that it's expressed in the term substance or substratum, that which underlies the others? There's in that sense more real because it causes the others. Well, if so, the word substratum should mean that it is spread under the sensory qualities, or isn't that right? It's something that's basic to them. Sure. And consequently, it underlies not only the sensory qualities that it produces in minds, but it underlies extension, being extended in space. Yes, that sounds right. And that something distinct from and exclusive of extension is supposed to be the substratum of extension. Yes, just so. Answer me. Can a thing be spread without extension? You take things in a strictly literal sense. This guy, he objects, you're being too literal here. He says to Berkeley. Berkeley replies, I'm not for imposing any sense on your words. You're at liberty to explain your meanings as you please. Only, I ask you, make me understand something by them. You tell me matter supports or stands under the sensory qualities. How? Is it the way your legs support your body? No, you're being too literal again. Then let me know any sense, literal or not, to make any sense of what you're telling me. Well, this opponent says, I don't know what to say at this point. And Berkeley replies, it seems then that you have no idea at all. Matter, you want to talk about and say that there's that which exists in itself and is purely physical, nor what relation it bears to accidents. Yeah, that's my position. And yet you asserted you could not conceive of how qualities, sensory qualities, should really exist without conceiving at the same time of a physical support for them. Yes, that's what I said. That is to say, when you conceive of the real existence of the qualities, you do it without conceiving of something of which you cannot conceive. In other words, the guy here is saying that the physical properties of a material object exist independently of any sensations. But then when he comes to talk about the physical properties that he knows, he only talks about sensations. And this essentially is what Berkeley's argument comes down to. I'm repeating deliberately what I've said before, just so I'm sure it's clear to you. Take any object you want to say. He wants to say of it that the object itself is physical, but it affects us by giving us sensations of it. Color, taste, touch, smell, so on. Now let's talk about its physical properties. It's extended in space. Do you have a perception of that? If so, you're not talking about something purely physical that's independent of sensations, you're talking about a sensation. His opponent wants to reply, no, I'm talking about the thing itself, I want to talk about its spatiality. And Berkeley argues then that idea, concept, comes down to more sensations. And this is what I did last time. Suppose we take the physical property of solidity. This is a solid object. What's that mean? It means that when it comes in contact with another object, neither can go right through the other without breaking it. It means that when one solid thing comes in contact with another, there's going to be a sound. It means that if one of the things that comes in contact with the other is a part of your body that has nerve endings in it, you're going to feel resistance. But what you're experiencing is the feeling of resistance, the sound of two things colliding, and the sight of two things impinging on one another, such that each resists the other, or if one does go through the other, it has to break it apart. Those are all sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds. In other words, you're trying to push on me the view that there's independent, purely physical things. and that they're the substance of the world that we live in. That which stands under and supports all the other kinds of qualities things seem to have in our ordinary everyday experience. But in fact, you're saying those things have only physical properties, and they cause us to experience sensations. So the color and touch and taste and sound and smell exist only inside our minds. What's outside is purely physical. But Berkeley goes on to do this with every physical property. They all come down to nothing but collections of sensations. And he argues it very well. And this made a terrific impact when he wrote and published this stuff. And what he comes to is the conclusion he comes to. He states this way. It's his statement's in Latin, and I can't help that. Too late to change it. But esse percipere means to be is to be perceived. That's what exists. Now, it's not really everything that exists that is perceived in Berkeley's system here, because it, in other words, perceptions. But there are also minds. So, Berkeley's ontology, based on this epistemological argument, is that there are minds and there are perceptions that exist in minds, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is the whole of reality. He does this also, he supplements this by another argument, and he argues against there being general concepts, that is, what we used to be called universals. Abstract general is the term he uses. Suppose we have the abstract general concept, man. What is the content of this? And Berkeley argues that we never think of man in general. That when we say that, that doesn't have any content. When we talk about man and we mean them all, we think of one, someone. And then we add the proviso that we mean all the rest too, but we don't have a percept of all humans. We can talk about it anyway. But that these abstract general terms really have as their content a perception. Whether we're talking about all men or sheep or farms or whatever it is, we have what's in our mind at the time, the notion in our mind, is some recollection of a man or the rough outline of one, of a sheep, of a farm. And he wants to say that these things that we take as abstract general are not different from the single perceptions that he's reducing everything to. So, let's see if I can find a good statement of that in his. Nobody denies that there are minds, and what minds know are ideas. But this is unfortunately only a matter of definition. Minds know only ideas if you define the objects of knowledge to be ideas. Unfortunately, the term idea has carried as many special meanings of its own as had the objectionable expression material substance. And that turned out not to mean anything except sensations. So, how is Berkeley going to get away with this kind of a view and still keep science? isn't science, isn't physics about the purely physical objects? He does it this way. And he does not understand the existence of bodies, that is, collections of sensations, as body, an abstract general idea that doesn't have any content. The content really exists in our mind when we use that term, just like what happens when we use the term man or sheep or farm, and we mean all of them, doesn't have a, it has one particular one in mind, literally in mind, and takes that one to stand for all the rest. Now, let's see what he does about science, though. When we say that friction causes heat, we mean that certain ideas, sensations of rubbing, and are always accompanied by sensations of heat. In other words, that friction is the sign of heat. It's a mistake, therefore, to think that the natural sciences can ever prove anything. On the contrary, the function of the science is merely to describe accurately the observable relations between one set of sensations and another. In other words, science is not there to prove a particular theory or another. It's there to say that when I experience X, Y, and Z, then next I experience A, B, and C. It's there to describe, to trace out these causal pathways, these one set of sensations that follows from another. Now, we puzzled at the beginning how, if he is going to get rid of physical objects, is there going to be any science? And the answer is he changes the whole idea of science. Science doesn't just observe that one set of sensations is followed by another. Science tries to explain why A, B, and C always follow X, Y, and Z. And it's the why that about which they make differing theories as to how that comes about. And the theories can and often do contain things no one has ever seen, heard, tasted, touched, or smelled. That's the sort of more normal, I'll call it, view of science. So it's tough for him, it's a tough sell. But there are other things that follow from this that he finds very congenial to his worldview. One of them is that it answers the question whether God's existence is capable of proof. And Berkeley thinks it is. He takes a standard objection to his view. Here's the objection to his view. We light a candle, and everybody leaves the room. Everybody comes back in half an hour, and the candle has burned down. Now, if the candle is nothing but a bunch of perceptions, and perceptions can exist only in minds, when we removed all the people from the room, that set of perceptions that we call a candle should have ceased to exist. But isn't it obvious that it continued to exist, which is why it's burned down? Berkeley's answer to that is best captured, I think, in a little limerick that I learned a long time ago about Berkeley's view. And it'll be easy for you to remember this, and it will summarize his ontology. The limerick goes like this. There was a young man who said, God. must find it exceedingly odd when he sees that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. So the young man's a student, as Barclay envisioned, as the author of the limerick envisions it. The author of the limerick was not Barclay. The young man walking across the quadrangle at the college sees the tree and is puzzled. Wait a minute. God must think it's really odd that this tree continues to exist when there's no one around in the quad and no one's perceiving it. Percepts can't exist unperceived. They are perceptions. To his surprise, though, in the limerick, the young man gets a letter from God. Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad, and that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God. And that's Barclay's ontology. What exists are sensation bundles. This particular sort of bundle we call a candle plus candlestick. We have the candle holder and the candle. The reason this continues to exist when there's no one in the room is that there's a mind that perceives everything all the time. So on Barclay's view here, he doesn't construct a proof of the existence of God. You see? For Descartes, it's premise, 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 therefore God exists. For Barclay, God's a hypothesis that answers a question everybody would have to face. If the material of the world is sensations, if what the world is made of, the world that we experience, nothing more than sensations bundled together into objects, then how can they continue to exist when no one perceives them? And the answer is there has to be at least one mind that perceives everything all the time. So it's a hypothesis, but it's the only one, in Barclay's view, that can answer the question, how does everything continue to exist when no humans perceive those things? And the answer is God. God's the one who sustains our minds and gives us the perceptions that we get. So God not only created the world, but he continually creates it and sustains all the perceptions all people that ever have. And if you then ask, then what's the meaning of the word exist? And that's to exist is to be perceived or to be a mind. It's often quoted in the Latin in other works, S.A.S. Percipi, to be is to be perceived. If you try to talk about something that you do not and cannot perceive, then you end up talking about nothing at all. Those words that you use that are supposed to be full of sound and fury actually signify nothing. And that's a standard point with all people that hold this view that makes perception primary. This view is called, in philosophy, later, phenomenalism. Phenomena is a Greek term that means an appearance. The ancient Greeks distinguished between the appearance of a thing and the thing and the what underlies the appearance. They did the same thing. They said there's the substance, the substratum. of a thing, and that's its physical properties. And then this thing gives rise to all the other kinds of properties that we perceive it to have. But Berkeley is arguing there are not many others. These all come down to one kind of thing, namely the appearances. There it is in Greek, phenomena, the appearances. So phenomenalism is the view that there is no substance, there are only the phenomena. And that view is going to be stated as clearly as possible and argued for as rigorously as possible by the next figure we cover, David Hume. And he, when he gets done, there's no world, there are no minds, there's no self, there's no God, there's no material substance, there's nothing. And that's what provoked Kant. But this is a significant step on the way to what provokes Kant. A hypothesis is an all-knowing mind is the only thing that could answer this. Now, that doesn't show that there's only one all-knowing mind. That's Berkeley's hypothesis. But if you say to him, how do we know there aren't five or 13 and a half all-knowing minds? He hasn't got an answer for that. And he is not, by that, shown that this all-knowing mind, that he calls God, he doesn't hesitate to use that term, that all-knowing mind is good. It's all-powerful in the sense that it's the source of all the perceptions that occur in all minds. That's true, but it doesn't show that God cares a fig about human beings. So for all he knows, there could be many such gods. They'd have to all agree on which perceptions to give people. Or maybe he might say, no, there are a couple of them that don't agree, and they get to send different perceptions to people, and we regard those people as insane. He did say that there are no laws that govern the world. What we call laws is just the average way we see God do things. So the real reason why ABC follow from XYZ is that's the way God brings them about. Whenever he does XYZ, he then brings about ABC. And when those occasions he brings about something different, we call it a miracle. But laws, there are no rigid laws. There's just the average way God does things. Well, it's serious though, isn't it? That Berkeley will go ahead and assume that God revealed in Scripture that fills this role, when he can't show that there's only one such being, that being is good rather than evil, that being cares about humans, or he can't get anywhere near that human provides a way of redemption for all humans. No, he can't get to any of that stuff with this argument. But this argument made an impact, believe me, especially the stuff that goes, pick any supposedly physical characteristic. Let's take this time, wait. And what this means is that we feel tactile sensation, pressure on our hands when we lift it. And it registers so many pounds on a scale. We can see the scale. That counts as a perception. We can see the needle turn on the dial and see where it stops. That's an indicator of what we're calling weight, that's an indicator of how much pressure we'd feel if we picked it up. So it's also we see it fall if unsupported. And we can add the usual additions to that, provided it's in the gravitational pull of the Earth, provided it's not too far from the Earth, and provided it's not a lighter than air object, we'll see it fall if unsupported. But those are all sensations. Right? They're all things we see, feel by touch. And if you mean something more than that by weight, go ahead and tell me what it is. That's sparkly. And it does this for all the supposedly physical properties. And he has thereby done what comes to be called in philosophy, he reduces the physical to the sensory. And you might want to use the term phenomenal there instead of sensory. Or Locke used sensitive, but he known by the senses. And this term becomes the term for any argument that says that there appears to be this kind of thing in the world, but actually there's only this kind of thing. What you think is a different kind of thing over here are actually some combination of these things over here, so that really there are only these things. That's called a reduction argument. So if you hear people use that term, you come across it in any of the reading, they're not talking about a weight loss program. They're talking about a certain kind of argument. An argument that says, there appear to be these things, but really, there are not, there are only these kind of things. And Berkeley starts right out with one of the most famous reduction arguments given. Kant is going to try to get around this. Kant says that as a philosopher, he himself was kind of adult till he read Hume. He said, I was a sleeping dogmatist. I just took for granted there was external physical objects, sensory copies in here, plus logical concepts. I took that for granted. And then I read Hume and I saw it could all be mowed down by this vicious reduction argument. And he says, this is not saving science. This is destroying it. Berkeley doesn't rescue science. He changes what we mean by the word. We don't mean just describing causal pathways as we encounter them and see them, but we mean postulating causal pathways we can't see and other hypotheses of things we can't see in order to explain what we can see. Take atomic theory. Are there little tiny things called atoms? And do they make up the big things, the things like this desk and our own bodies? Well, by now, we have tons of evidence that there really are atoms. And that we know a great deal about their nature because we know enough about that nature to know that if we do this, this, and this with enough of them, this results. And we figure it out in advance what should result and get the result. That doesn't prove the theory, but it confirms it. If you remember my little talk on the difference between prove and confirm. So there is so much of that we have at our fingertips, so where there's nobody today doubts the atomic theory. Well, that's what closer to what science is about. It's about postulating theories and testing them, carrying them out, and making inferences and so on. And Kant says, Berkeley didn't do that. He didn't save that. He wrecked it. So we're going to continue. We'll wind up Berkeley next time and have a preparatory to Hume's shock. See you then.